Session number 22353, Reel 2.
Eric Warburton, Reel 2.
Well, training was, as I say, now to equip us, the ambulances and the vehicles, with their various equipment, and the also the panniers had all got surgical instruments in them and medical equipment, etc. And one had to know exactly what was what was what and where did they fit, so that in the event of darkness you could do this job without you know, without thinking about it, which was quite useful, obviously. But in the midst of all this preparation, they started to evacuate from Dunkirk, and our services were not required. And so we spent some little time in Harpenden, which was very tedious, really, because you were geared up to do something and then nothing happened. Although, in a way, one was pleased that the Dunkirk business had escaped us, or we had escaped being involved. And so that was the first time that one began to feel that it was a bit more than playing soldiers, as it had hitherto been. And so we sort of went back to sort of the night route marches and things like that, and that which were a bit sometimes they were a bit tedious as well, because it was just a matter of marching all night, and therein is I found myself in charge of the water pump for the officers were billeted in the house itself, Rothamsted House, and it had water pumped to it by a little dynamo, etc., that was in a shed, and I was put in charge of this to make sure that the officers had enough water. And of course, being sort of trying to be clever, etc., I thought, now if I work this right, I will avoid these route marches. And so, by slight adjustment of this dynamo, the belt would come off, and the pump would stop working. And then I would be called upon and said, you know, try and get this right, because the officer's water is running out. And it was surprising how by morning, or the following morning, I had discovered what the problem was, and that the water was now flowing adequately into the officer's mess tank, the supply tank. And this happened a number of times, but nobody seemed to have cotton on. So I was the man that was sort of creating a problem. And that was one of the army things that one learned to do in the army. It was to do little things which were to your own advantage. And so I found myself regularly called upon, but especially when I heard that there might be a route march coming up. We then followed on. We got moved to Luton Hoo, and there we lived in the stables. We had been living in tented accommodation in Rothamsted Park, but this was now an improvement. They were very, very luscious stables, and a very comfortable stay we had there. and we were there for quite some time as well. We had a move then to Welwyn Garden City, and we had Trevelyan House, was the cottage hospital which we took over, and life as medical people began, as it were, for me anyway, because here was an opportunity to get some experience of ward work, and that we had obviously military personnel being brought in as patients, and therefore we did what was called a shift, as it were, at work in this hospital, doing minor things, mainly looking after minor illnesses and things of that nature.
So you weren't dealing with wounds?
No, oh no, not at this time. No, we were still, everybody was in good order, as it were. And so it was a very minor, minor training. But nevertheless, it was a move forward, and we were now sort of doing some active work as far as the medical side was concerned. There was no surgical side involved at this stage. And the whole stay in Welwyn Garden City was dealing with training, that is, attending lectures on the most of the medical and the surgical side, but nothing of a real nature. It was all training, and it was all book work, but very useful, and of course very satisfactory from people who were interested. But I was still an NO1. No, I was an NO2, and had this one ring, and I thought, oh, it's, you know, really it's time that I got the second ring, which was it was difficult to get, and it depended what sort of work you were involved in. And so I just resorted really to just normal soldiering again, that is, guard duties and picket duties. There was one occasion when a Dornier plane came down, German plane came down, and I'd started machine gunning along one of the streets in Welwyn Garden City, and eventually it landed somewhere in the Hatfield area. And that was the sign that war was getting very close. Well, we were getting close to war, and that was our first experience of this sort of thing happening. So, and of course that was the year when, well, it was the time when the CO was being retired. At least he was being retired from us, and we were to have a new CO, and this Colonel Lister was called for all the, had a major parade of all the unit, A and B company, as well as HQ, and all the RESC attached, and he addressed them and said his farewells, and at the end said, "So this is Popeye saying goodbye to his jeeps." So he knew all the time, of course, that we all called him Popeye, not to his face. And so that was the end of Colonel Lister's stay with us, and we then had a change of CO.
Are you saying Popeye saying goodbye to his what?
Jeeps.
Why jeeps?
Well, because there was cartoons in those days in the papers, Jeeps were the sort of, and Popeye were, went together in this.
But what were the Jeeps?
Oh, they were these little little people that were
creatures.
Creatures, that's right. So that was something of a light-hearted side of the army, I suppose, to have these people that were causing amusement in the army ranks, as it were, or any service ranks. So, nothing of any seasick consequence used to arrive in that area, and eventually we were sent down to Ashford in Kent, and stayed at a place called Smeath Paddocks, and life was now becoming sort of varied. I got to know by this time officers, and that there were things such as batmen, and they were the QM stores took on a new sort of aspect, and that in fact that the quartermaster in particular was came to the fore, and he, it was his job to see that supplies were kept up, and maintenance of the building was now a major thing, and that as I had been involved in the building industry, I found myself now being utilized as running repairs to the house in which we were, and other jobs. Now the other jobs, one of which was across the road was the house in which the officers' mess was established, and the officers lived there as well. And they had a gas supply to this place, and the gas was generated by a mixture of aviation petrol and and water, and it this machine was in a sort of lean-to by the side of the house, and it outside was a derrick of some 30 feet high, with a weight on it, and down came, as it proceeded down, it was regulated. It regulated a mixing process of these two liquids, and which resulted in gas being produced, and that supplied into the house. All went well until Christmas time, or in the winter time, I should say, and the winter in that particular time was very, very, very hard. And I think we're now about 1942, I suppose, the machine became frozen, and this became a bit of a problem, and to keep it, in fact, workable. And I had to do this by various means of heat, generating some sort of heat one way or another, but being very careful that no sort of flame, etc., would get anywhere near this machine. In recourse, it would blow up. So, but things got worse, and eventually I was given an assistant to ensure that this machinery went. And unfortunately, the assistant put a paraffin lamp underneath. There was a reservoir underneath the machine. And he got it going so warm that there was the drain cock at one end, of course, had been left open. And it became a flame. In fact, the whole place burnt down. It was quite a serious matter, really. I thought, oh dear, this is my first major problem in the army, and I'd heard about courts martial and all sorts of things, and so in the immediate future, in the immediate instant, there was most of the officers turned out, and they threw buckets of water on this thing, and they played firemen and all sorts of things, and this weight, great weight, had now come down with a terrific bang and went down and sunk itself into about 6 feet of the earth. So with this, I thought that enough had happened and I'd better go and seek my boss's consolation or whatever. Consoling was the right word for me. So as I appeared along the path toward the road, ready to cross the road, he arrived, you see, and he said, "What's the matter with you?" He being a promotion as well. I said, "You've not seen the fire." "What's that?" So I said, well, I told him briefly what had happened. I said, I don't know what's going to happen. He said, "Well, go and lose yourself." And he was a great old man, really. He was in the First World War, actually, and he was a great man. And I liked him very much. "I think you better go and lose yourself," he said. So I did. And I never heard any more about it, apart from the fact that after it was all over, and the fire was out, and the officers now without any gas, etc., etc., we had to start rebuilding this shed. And the RASC were to put this thing right, the machinery right, and eventually all went well and was repainted and everything went in order. And what to me was a disaster had now been overcome, and the weather was now improved, and nothing was ever heard of it again. So I don't know who did what, who picked up the tab for doing it.
This is at Smith.
This is at Smith, yes, yes. And so anyway, I thought, well, it's about time I retired from doing building work. I think I better start myself getting interested in the medical side again, so, and a bit less harm. It was that I decided that I went into the stalls then, and Lackery Wood, who was the lieutenant quartermaster, we became on a quite friendly basis, or friendly is not really the right word, I suppose. But he was, he's a likable man, and I started to work for him indoors, as it were, in the stores, and that was an interesting thing. He was a type of man who had made his mark in life, as it were, and he would come out of the gate at Smith, and for instance, and the soldier who would be RASC on the gate who would come to smart his attention and present whatever and salute him, and he would walk past with his hands stuck firm in his pockets, and then he'd take two or three paces and he'd come back again, and he'd say to the man, "You're new here, aren't you?" And the man said, yes, sir. Yes. Well, if there's nobody about, you don't think I'm going to take my hands out of my pocket to return your salute, so don't bother. And that was Lacrae. And it was quite something. And another instance of his likability really was that he would say, and I don't think, I hope this doesn't get anybody into any problems, he would say to me, I would expect to go to him and say, could I have his signature, you see? And he would say, oh yes, so he'd put his signature to whatever document it was. And then came time for a bit of leave. And, of course, the thing in the army, when you're going on a 48 pass, you couldn't get a more than a 48 pass in those days. 48-hour pass, that is. But if you lived a long way away, it was impossible to get home and back again on a 48-hour pass and spend any time at home. So you would have a 36-hour pass to get there, a 36-hour pass to get back. So you managed to get about 4 days eventually, or 3 days at home, that type of thing. And so this happened a time or two at Smeeth, because we were doing these things. And so I would ask him for to sign some pass, as you see. And he would say to me, why are you bothering me with this? And I said, well, because my CMI officer, you see. So he'd say, you've been working for me for 6 weeks now, or more. You know my signature. I'll show you once again. And afterwards, you sign your own passes. And I can still write Lacrae Wood's signature. Of course, it was very distinctive. And so that was it, as far as that session of that sort of work, I think. We had various incidents. We're now getting more bold as far as the surgical side, and so a type of room was created in the Smeeth paddock in the house, where they did little minor operations, and so that became interesting. Also created an incident where I decided to make a certain standard, and I because I'd been doing bits of carpentry and things like that in a room as well, and I'd got a little gatehouse type of thing. And nobody else went and used it, and so I went in there, and I bought a trumpet, and so I used to do a little practice in there. Of course, I'd kept my lip in, as they call it in the musical world. And one day, an officer came to me and said, I'd like to see you in my room this evening. So, and of course I went, and dear Jack, because he was great, became a great friend of mine, and he said, I would like to have been a dance band leader. The word dance horrified me. So he said, Jeff Hamm is good on the piano, and we've got, and Mann is very good with his drums, and with you on your trumpet, I think that this would be an ideal beginning of a unit dance band. And so I thought I would mention it to you. I've heard you practicing in the gatehouse. And so I said, I'm sorry, sir, but I can't do that. My principles will not allow me. And he said, really? What sort of principles are those? I'm interested, I would like to know more. So I told him that the Salvation Army and dance bands did go well together. In fact, they were forbidden. And I said, they are my principles and that I cannot do. And so it was the beginning of a friendship of very, he was a very kind man. He was a qualified surgeon, a medical officer, and he was extremely good and very, very dapper man. And we were friends for over 51 years. And I greatly respected him, and we had a wonderful time, both during the rest of the war time, although he was posted abroad. He went into Chinditz eventually, but we still kept in contact, not regularly, but throughout our lives we kept contact.
What was his name?
Jack Dupe. And he is mentioned in one of the little books that are written about the Chinditz. And he was mentioned in dispatches and things of that nature, and he did remarkably well. So that was that. Eventually, when he came out of the army, he went into the Royal Canadian Navy as a surgeon commander, and then switched over to the Australian Navy in the same role. And after that, he went to he came home as Port Medical Officer of Health for Southampton, and then went on to Harwich. So that was one of the two men most important to my life, really. And he was very a great man. So back to Smith, we went to eventually from there we were doing spells in Dover Castle. As you know, in Dover Castle there are these catacombs, and we went into there preparing what is now established as a hospital within the catacombs, and they are now showing it as a museum. And my first night down in the castle was actually on the upper floor of the tower, and the shells now were coming about thick and fast, of course, across the channel. And I decided that one night was enough as an exposed position like that sort.
Was the castle hit by the shells?
No. I don't know. It always overshot. And the road called the Military Road behind there was regularly receiving these shells. But they didn't hit the castle, as far as I recall. But I don't remember anything. And one of the funny incidents, of course, was that some of the chaps that went down to begin to put this hospital together and whatnot, start erecting beds, things of that nature, There was a little gallery outside the, one of the doors. There was it's still there actually. There's this railings, as it were, around the balcony, and you look out there, and you look down to, in those days, you looked straight down onto the port, and of course they had colliers in those days, nothing like the ships of today. They were all fired by coal and things of that nature, and of course the